Apologies for Mr. Minister Maynard and Member Mitchell will be late. I think Member Mvimbi might also be late. I think he's also on transport. Okay. I'm going to first allow for the members to introduce themselves and then for the officials to introduce themselves, and then we're going to jump right into the Inequality Trends Report presentation.
Morning, Chair. Andrikus van der Westhuizen, member of the committee.
Morning, Chair. I'm Nomi Nkondlo, member of the committee.
And the officials today?
Thank you. I'm Nadia Ibrahim. I'm going to lead the provincial treasury discussion for today. Apologies for my HND and the other members. I'm going to let my team introduce themselves. We'll start with Mr. Mazumbo.
Good morning, members. My name is Apiwa Mazumbo. Director responsible for financial systems in provincial treasury.
Good morning, Chair. Fabian Daniels from the provincial government budget office.
Good morning. Nobahle Siluluane from provincial treasury budget management office, local government.
Good morning, members. I'm Tambela Nabe, also from provincial treasury budget office.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to first hand over to you.
Thank you. Do you want to put the one mic off me, please? Just a minute.
Morning, everybody. Mugin Mohammed from PMG.
Should we jump right into the presentation?
We've got it wrong with the second presentation.
Can we start with that?
Want to start with Dr. Fern, and we can do that?
Yeah.
But I'm going to do that presentation. Can we actually go to the first slide? So I think the topic is on data mining and dashboarding on the SEM performance information. We did, however, introduce this in our feedback on the annual reporting and focusing on some of the initiatives that we use within the supply chain space in dealing with performance information differently. So it's a vast area of topics. It's a vast area in which I can share with you a lot of things. But I focus the presentation basically on our background and where we started and what is the thinking and where we're heading to, and then basically moving into giving you examples of data sets that we look at within the provincial treasury. It's much wider than the examples that we have. Some of it is work in progress as well, where we're venturing towards. So basically the problem statement, and you would see there's two aspects that we dealt with. One was on a system kind of context, where we found that data analysis in many areas was very labor intensive. So it's either manual capturing on workbooks or somebody keeping information in a particular space. We do have the system. So you have the three financial systems, which is the Logos, BAS, and Purcell. But those three don't connect in terms of wanting to do the comparative analysis in terms of various areas of financial management. We also have the e-procurement system, which is a little bit outside of the National Treasury suite of legacy systems that is a provincial initiative that has been operating for the last 20 years, which also doesn't integrate with the current systems as well as a supply database. So you find that information from a system perspective becomes quite challenging. It's very manual, labor-intensive process. And I'm talking way back since 2012 when we started with this project. We required intervention for service that puts data in a format that requires further work around cleansing and analysis. So what evolved within the SIFS component, within my colleague, the KITSO application that we used with the National Treasury in developing the system to actually consume the BAS information in a more appropriate manner. We've also used some of that on Purcell, but I think it's more SEM focused now, so I'll focus on how we use KITSO. Then the data interfaces from different financial systems I spoke, they're not always possible, but and not done in many instances, or further as labor intensive that I spoke to. Data integrity was also the problem, because when you manually input and you're sitting with different levels of operations on the system, the data input becomes problematic, because a simple thing, so if I use my, if I'm a supplier and it's Nadia Ibrahim and company, you may have different people, one saying it's Nadia E or it's N Ibrahim and company, or you, there's a space in between the name, or you may spell Ibrahim in a different way or Nadia in a different, so you have capturing of the same thing in so many different ways. And no uniform conventional rules that you could pull through. So those are some of the challenges, one of the examples that we could look at. But also what's in the information. For example, the one of the critical things of pulling data is a contract number. And in many instances, you have this option that says contract or no contract, and they would choose the no contract option, you know, with not capturing, not necessarily having a uniform contract number across the province. So things that we need to look at in terms of how do we configure, what are the compulsory fields of capture, what are the options that are available to staff, and how do we control that space in terms of and various initiatives on how we do data cleansing in the province, which has actually improved some of the systems required. Then KIPSO information, as I said, was only from a BAS perspective, and we're still looking at how do we reconcile LOGIS, personal information, the supply database information, and our e-procurement system. But then the whole scenario from a procurement perspective was how do we look at this ability of us, and I think moving towards the socioeconomic profiling, and how do we, what do we spend on? Are we empowering? You know, in terms of using procurement as a lever for procurement, how many black-owned companies get work, how many small businesses get work, what types of commodities get work, are the spread of suppliers that are actually getting the work sufficiently, and what our departments are spending on. So various aspects, and how do we look at socioeconomic preferential procurement perspectives in terms of national imperatives that are coming through on the table. Then also the second aspect, how do we have oversight and surveillance over critical high-risk areas, like you find that the Auditor General coming in with various things like irregular expenditure, lack of utilization of the competitive bidding process. How do we pick those early warning signs from a system? Because you're also sitting with financial and non-financial information, and whilst there's a huge challenge on the financial side, on the system, the bigger problem is the non-financial data sets as well, because you do assessment reports, you're going to do different things within the supply chain space. How do you look at spec, which is sitting on a hard copy document that's within a bit within the document? And how do you look at improving some of that non-financial information that is a huge source of intelligence that could be used to improve on the supply chain space? Then to enable and move from a basic compliance agenda, so what you find that when you look at financial and what we term in the finance space as financial capability maturity, there's different levels or stages of involvement within any institution or any government profile. And all our departments are not at that same level, but how do you begin? First, compliance is non-negotiable, or governance is non-negotiable. How do you implement and embed good governance within the SCM space? But how do we begin start addressing service delivery in a different way, about efficiencies, about value for money, about at grassroots level, how does it land in the public space? And those are some of the conversations we were having in how do we look at procurement differently. And you'll see that being coming through in our VRT. So how do we produce procurement information in a format? As a treasury, having access to the information is a burden in itself, but it's also a very important tool to have to be able, not just for our oversight, but how do we support our departments in a way that begins to help them to improve their decision-making within the financial space. So that's basically the problem statement on how we started this whole conversation of data mining. Go to the next slide. Okay, so the initial need in 2013-14, how do we improve logistics management, how do we strengthen relationships with suppliers and customers with a focus? How do we seamlessly integrate supply chain demand activities across provincial departments? And how do we monitor departmental spend within the allocated budget and improve procurement planning, which is a key focus, and then identify strategic commodities to lead over those economic. And then we started with that process in 2013-14 and began to look at how do we focus on the systems and data. Evolving needs for 2015, and you'll see
particular in the States, the ACM review that came from National Training,
placing the entire country
in a particular space. However, we were not replacing totally because we had already shown improvements. We had clean orders and all kinds of good things.
But where we want to go
from a performance agenda
still needed a lot of work.
So the question was, how do we promote this space of procurement planning became a critical aspect? Because if we could embed that, then the efficiency gains around improvements becomes much easier. How do you improve visibility in spend and the achievement of efficiencies in
expenditure management? How do you improve decision making? How do you achieve value for money? How do you look at data analytics and a visualization tool to facilitate analysis and extracting of data? How do we position commodities based on strategic drivers to develop commodity strategies for identified functional areas that and requests from departments? And then establish a report on supplier positioning strategies. So it's much wider than just the internal focus, but how do we look at supply? Okay, so the data analysis and visualization focus on these three main areas. How do we look at data gathering and extraction? So what are the points, the touch points of our sources? So
gathering and extracting from the various data feed systems and other sources. And
how do we have, obviously the system couldn't integrate by itself. How do we begin to have a mechanism to be able to integrate the information? How do, and look at structuring, mapping of data from various data sources. How do we look at data validation and cleansing? So key focus on how do we deal or tackle the credibility issues. So this had to be done in the system itself, but also outside of the system when we pull the information, you know, into a very credible kind of a reporting or dashboard. Then data integration or enrichment. What is the ability of the Western Cape to look at spend data with supply performance data, look at risk issues, compliance information, and other identified sources that we'll use to look at business intelligence analysis or value add analysis of the data. In data classification, I think this becomes a very important aspect of it. How do we categorize the data in terms of commodity classification system? Because you may have naming conventions that are different in each system. So an entity may be something in one system, while it may mean something else in a different system. We may refer to department or institution. How do we begin to pull all of that so we're talking the same thing, but obviously you can't change the information coming out of the system because they call it a different thing, but have this built in so that it begins to bring the right kind of information into a common space. And then data management service, looking at, do we do this monthly? How do we feed the data to be real-time or uptime? Is it about on-the-fly kind of information that it's done, you build an interface, or is it going into a data store, and then the cleansing and all of that happens, and you do a monthly update? So what is it that you want to see, and when do you want to see it? It becomes very critical, I think. We take these things for granted, but when you're actually sitting with the information, it becomes critical when you communicate. And then the responsibility of that communication, because, for instance, if I have to come to the standing committee and you need certain information and I pull the data at a certain time, maybe before the year-end reconciliation of the journal entries are put through, you will get a totally different picture as when I come through midway past the month of the following. You know, so what happens in time and space becomes critical. So how do you begin and what is the service of the data management capacity that you're building in? The data analysis tool, what are we using? What is the mechanism? So you'll see that in the province, we use the Power BI tool. We had explored on different things. But for supply chain, I think over the years, from 2013 onwards, we partnered with CEI in terms of looking at their current biz platform. And we use, so at the time, in the market, if you look at Gartner's Magic Quadrant, at the time, you would find a system that was called Tableau, was top of the Magic Quadrant, was the best in the world. When we started with the process, we had outsourced this to a service provider to pull that in. But with that system, you found that a lot of the things has to be done by somebody else. The system is very good at pulling the data. But if you're sitting with outside of the packages of the Microsoft platform, you're still having to bring everything in line to that. But by then, Microsoft Power BI had already come into the space. So if you look at the magic quadrants currently in time and space, you'll find Microsoft Power BI is contending with the best in the market. So that transitioning became very easy when we actually moved to actually deal with Microsoft Power BI and partnering with CEI in that space as well. Next slide. So there's two aspects of it. So when you're looking at business intelligence, I think it's important to understand you have one which is called the desktop version, or that basically is non-customizable, so which means upfront you needed to think about, if I build the data mart and I want this kind of reporting, you build that upfront and then automatically feeds in with all the data convention rules and stuff that you have. But you have, whenever you draw that, it's in the stock standard reports that come through. Or do you want to look at a self-service business intelligence tool? Now, a self-service business intelligence tool is where it enables business users, which is the managers and the practitioners that are actually preparing the reporting, to access and analyze business data without IT involvement. So it's not an automatic interface that creates a dashboard at the end. So you kind of create on-the-fly dashboard. So also while you're sitting within the system, if I as a treasury, I'm presenting that what's important for me is looking at your ability to spend within the quarters and your ability to meet your cash flow requirements or according to the procurement plan, what you've projected that you're spending. But a department may want to know much more micro details. So they may want to say, what are the bottlenecks? And if I'm looking at this, who are the, if it's about capturing 30-day payments, who are the users and who are the culprits that are not doing that? They can actually drill down further into the system to actually deal with that information, because that becomes important for them to manage their own internal controls and risks. So at a point in time, we had to make that decision. So Treasury beginning to use a self-service model for SCM became a very important aspect, because it helped us to drill down and drill up. It gave us drill down and drill up, drilling up functionalities where we could assist the department to actually have bespoke kind of interventions in terms of dealing with their information sets in a different way. So it also helped us to present data visually within the tool in a meaningful way, because when we're engaging with departments and I have connectivity to the tool and the information, if I'm having a quarterly in governance engagement and they're asking questions, you can very quickly go into the tool and present the message that you're trying to actually deal with. So it played a strong role, not just from a compliance perspective as well, but it also gained credibility with our departments in terms of how do we strengthen this conversation and relationship, and we work as a collective to strengthening the supply chain environment within the province. So fast analytics, ease of use, big data, any data were the kind of things that we looked at, smart dashboarding. So when you talk about fast analytics, it's about connect and visualize data in minutes. So as you look at it on the fly, I can build a dashboard for you. That was what we wanted. Ease of use. Anyone can analyze the data with intuitive drag and drop functionality. So you don't need to be a systems techie to be able to do the kind of reporting. So all you needed to know is, how does this tool operate? What am I looking for? What do I draw in from the score of items that are presented to create the kind of dashboarding that I want? Big data, any data. How do I bring in information from spreadsheets to database, from SQL formatting servers, and explore any kind of data information that can interfere into the tool? And then smart dashboards. How do you combine multiple views of data for richer insight? So if I'm using it from different system, but I have a different sets of dashboards, how do they interplay with each other? Should I want a different view, to combine or to separate them in a particular way? So self-service became a very important aspect of defining the needs within the procurement space. Next slide. Okay, so this is just a mapping to say how we've actually put through. So Treasury on the top would deal with SCOA classification and how you would actually take the information from BAS through, and we use Kitso as a middleware that kind of consume the data within the space via the mapping tables, and then also using your kind of Western Cape governance CETA supplier database. How do you pull that information? And then you see logos and other sources, which is we're not there yet, that's what we're intending to do, but bring it into a kind of SQL data mart that begins to look at various aspects. And you'll see some of the kinds of dashboarding that you would see on that we could produce, and the thinking around how this is pulled together. Okay? So this is just what data mining is. And when we talk data mining, it's about how do you look at all these systems there that come into, and it becomes not just data, but it becomes intelligence. You know, and from intelligence, it becomes a much more performance kind of enriched data. Yeah. Right? Next slide. So the examples that we use, and I know it's quite diverse. So for me, it was a challenge on what I needed to show the committee in terms of what, because you'll probably, once I take you through, you'll be very interested to see everything, and we'll be here the whole day, or the whole week for that matter, because it's a lot of information, and it's very interesting insight, depending on the kind of question. So just to give you an insight into what we have. So we have the triple BE, triple PF supplier analysis. So we can tell you things like, who do we do business with? How much do we spend on the different categories that are actually within the supply chain? Small companies, big companies, so the pre-qualification, although we don't use the set aside, and you'll be familiar with it when I presented on the triple PEF analysis, there were certain certain challenges that we had. But I can still give you that. In our database, we find sufficiently to pick up who are military veterans, who are women-owned companies, men-owned companies, 51% of the year. Payments and supplies for designated categories. So in terms of the requirements, who are the designated categories? How do you begin to get that? Spend analysis per region. So we have geo-mapping in the system within the areas of the, not just the Western Cape. But at the Western Cape, we have them much more at a district level. You can even go to the municipal region and even in the national space as well. So if I want to geo-map even further on the national space, I can tell you within which municipal district. But for now, we just say, okay, it's Gauteng province, and then, oh, it's KZN, because it's not needed for us to know that, because it's not our objective to implement the regional kind of thing. While it's the provincial, we go much more to the micro level to show you where you're spending. Potential for irregular expenditure. So, for example, some of the initiatives that I used that we flag for early warning signs are aspects around conflict of interest, payments in respect of such conflict. So what we call it is potential conflict of interest. So we would flag on the system if a department did business with somebody registered on the supplier database who's actually employed by government. Okay? We can go further and match it to say, is there any payment made to this company? So in the next audit, this is going to be a potential for irregular expenditure, and we give this to information to the department to investigate. Because sometimes there could be a very reasonable reason why the supplier, because I could give you examples where it's about the ombudsman and that kind of thing. Because the national government, the supplier database is broader than just a supplier database. It deals with anybody you make payments to. So when you have that conundrum in there, when you get the payment, you're focusing on the payment information and not on the procurement information. So BAS deals with all the payment information. So a beneficiary could be a non-supplier vendor kind of engagement where you have made a payment to a beneficiary. So you'll pick up the auditor general. Or you'll pick up like maybe the ombud that we have to pay, you know, within comm safety. Or you'll pick up work that we would have done to a legal company or whatever else that may not be a procurement kind of thing. So we say potential. You also have certain members of government sitting on boards and those kind of things. So if there's payments made there, it may come up as a conflict. So we say potential conflict of interest, go back, investigate, come back and inform us, and then we flag the reasons of the system. So even for audit, you will say what are the, you eventually come to the conclusion there's an actual conflict of interest. Departments are doing their investigation. They're doing a disciplinary, or they're actually asking the person to deregister or not, or come out of the directorship of a company and those kind of things. So it's managing that. Deviations from competitive bidding. So some of the flags, although there's a stance that there's methods of procurement and you can use some of these things, but there's regulatory requirements on what you should, under which parameters to operate. So we can flag. because they're reporting on limited bids and expansions. So two us, this is just two of it. There's other stuff that we also pick up within the information that we put together. But just to tell you, this is how rich the data can be. If you actually kind of input is right, you can get a lot more. Then the IPS, which is the e-procurement system for quotations, we look at performance management of the system. So number of events, the commodity analysis, the supplier participation rate, so we can tell you who we do business with, who's getting work, what are the top spend, what are the opportunities to rationalize and look at consolidation. So we can advise our departments a lot on those kind of things. So just have this at the back of your mind. So I'm going to go into the examples as we go along, so you'll see how some of that comes up in the dashboarding. And what we do is we do a quarterly report to per department for every quarter with their information as well as some of the generic stuff that's coming across. At the end of the year, we do a consolidated report for the province to give us a full picture of where we find our departments in the space on all of that information. And then obviously in this year, we're going to enhance that much further, so there'll be much more in that report as we go along. Any examples, Mr. Nabi? Next slide. So this is an example of the IPS event. Now, it was the last example that I showed you. So you'll see in the 2018-19 financial year, the final report. So you see this is dealing with procurement below 500,000. So the total number of events or requests that we put through that system is 43,936 across the province. And so that's the volume. So that information in itself begins to look at what opportunities that we put out of the market for below 500,000. It also, if I go back into what's sitting there, it could look at opportunities to put bigger contracts, so efficiencies in the system. So for a Department of Health, I can see if all of the hospitals are doing different things, what are the opportunities to consolidate? Health can easily get that information. Or I can see, as a provincial treasurer, should I put a transversal contract? How often do they use it? Is it a once-off thing? That event has now come up to at least 60,000 that we do in that's on an average for financial year. So the second set of data is status of events. So I can know what's completed, what has been cancelled, what is pending selection. Important sets of information when you look at cancellation is it about why have they cancelled? Is it about better planning? Is it about spec not being right? Because you can pull that on the system as well to go back and drill down to the nitty-gritty information. And there you look at the bottom, the reasons for cancellation, for example. No suitable offers received. Incorrect specification. No responses received. Budgetary constraints. So these are the reasons that departments input in, and you see on the right, it can tell you the number that is affected by them. So important intelligence that allows us to go into and look at root cause analysis. So if it says incorrect specification, and if there's 601 of those events actually gave incorrect specifications, then it means what interventions do we do with these departments? Is it department specific, is it a department of department A, B, or C that's doing this? Is it a common thing across? Who do we focus on? What kind of things that we can do or intervene in as a treasury? Is it about no suitable offers? Why are they no suitable offers? You know, so those kind of conversations. Okay, so it's very important sets of information that can come from that, and it's about knowing what you need to know with this data as well. But also, sometimes they ask the wrong questions as well, and you could also skew that view. So having the ability to build even the competence of the treasury and my staff becomes critical in how we deal with this information. So example two, next one. Okay, this is the limited bidding that I was talking about. So you'll see, this is a huge thing in the national space, because deviations from the competitive bidding process. But you see that within the space, and if you look at Pareto principles, at least 80% of your bidding should be competitive. There would be that 20% that would fall within the space. And you'll see in this norm that if you look at that as a norm, you'll see we're comfortably within that space, you know, as a province. And you can actually go and say, what instances was it? You know, what was the reasoning behind, you know, departments actually doing that? And this is the collective thing in that year that we had for this, the 17-18 financial year. Go down to the next. This is the supplier per region that I spoke about coming from the database. How do we, are there active suppliers on the database? You know, the total numbers, you'll see we engage with at least 16,000 of that in that year. And how many of them were active on the national database? How many of them were active on our database? How many of them were suspended because of governance requirements? How many of them were suspended longer than 12 months? And then what are the total engagement that we do? Are they within a particular district within the Western Cape? So you can see who are we doing business with. These are the suppliers over that period. And the other would be they across the country. And you see the footprint. It also helps us, are we doing business with our local suppliers? And what are the number of suppliers that we engage on for that value? Okay, go down. Obviously, there's more dashboards. You can even go to kind of what value that is per region, per supply. Next slide. Then this is the BE example. You would have seen this in the SCOF presentation as well. So payments per BE level, and you see 1 to 4 is your what we call the SMMEs. So it's between the exempt micro enterprises and the qualified enterprises that deal within levels 1 to 4. And this is the target market for empowerment, creating emerging companies, small businesses, you know, getting more opportunity. So you'll see already I can track what we paid over that year, what were the percentage of the levels within that period, and then further breakdown because the new regulations speak to less than 51% and greater than at least 51%. So you'll see that split together with the percentage of spend over that period. And then the turnover category, so you'll see, did we spend on large QSE EMEs or wage was not indicated because suppliers also do that in terms of the total spend for that period that was our goods and services budget. Then matching to the supplier database and what that spend would be. Okay, so all of our suppliers that we did business with at that time was to the value of 10 billion, which is very close to the actual amount that we spent. Okay, so we didn't have non-compliance in that year to that amount. Not successfully met was the 77 million. Okay, next slide. Okay, this is the demographic. So we keep this, although we don't set aside because there's issues on the legality of the requirements, but we still monitor our spend where we're saying that even without the set aside, how do these pre-qualified suppliers that the regulations want us to put into our specification. Actually, how do they play and how do they fare across? So you'll see there's quite a reasonable, you know, display of how each of these categories get work in the Western Cape government and how and what is the value of that spend across. The first with military veterans, and you'll see that over the quarters what has been spent in those financial years. So we keep this as a going rate. But it will also help us as we go along to do other kind of investigation because it will see what kind of companies are registered on that and is it viable for the commodities that we purchase because it's about the rationality of the requirement in the regulations and you can't just set aside and you achieve because the target becomes unachievable by just setting it. And what is the opportunity in the market in terms of supply and demand? And what kind of initiatives can you actually do if we actually land our economic procurement policy, which we put on the table that can. In the next slide. This is the regional one, and I think this would also be very interesting. You'll see with the spend on goods and services, how much did we spend in the Western Cape? And you'll see that the other player in the market in the province that we spend on is Gauteng, because a large percentage of that, particularly on the medical space, supply is coming from Gauteng. And then you'll see within the other areas of the country that money is spent, Northern Cape, Western Cape, and you can go back into and say where in the Western Cape, you know, at the district level. So you'll see the districts on the top and the percentages that we spend in the district. large percentage of it is in the metropole, given the spread of provincial. This doesn't include municipal spend, it's just provincial spend. Okay, next slide. That's the last one. So there's a lot more. I just gave you a little bit to tantalize your interest to see what is the potential that we could. And if you want to see anything else, you can ask the question that I'm willing to make that information available, should we have that kind of dashboard. There are some things that are work in progress, but you're free to ask any of that and we'll be able to present that to you.
Thank you, members. I'm going to take questions before we go to the next presentation on this particular one because they deal with two different things. Member van Wester, I saw your hand.
Yes.
Member Nkondlo?
Yes, thank you, Chair. Thank you very much for this highly interesting topic for me personally. Questions in this regard. Perhaps I can start with a remark. Until May of last year, I served in the National Assembly. And at one stage, I served in the portfolio of what is now called Employment and Labour. And I was quite thrilled when we visited some of the state-owned factories which offer sheltered employment for those individuals that require sheltered employment. To see the Western Cape being one of the biggest supporters, although it was based in Gauteng, by having our towels that we use in our hospitals, provincial hospitals, imprinted there in that factory, and I don't know if that will also be classified under the heading of disabled, but yes, that showed me there what public spending can do to help people. Also, I used to serve on the portfolio committee for a while on public administration, and my question is, I do know that this has been coming for many, many years, that the BAS system is going to be replaced, that PASAL will hopefully also be replaced, that we will get an integrated system. And my question is just, the investment that you are now making in terms of the current systems, while I think we cannot wait indefinitely for these new systems to be implemented, but obviously we do not want that to be wasted. So if you could just tell us to what extent would you be able to then quickly adapt to a new public administration spending software system. The second question is, I recently happened to ask a question of the Minister of Local Government on what I thought would be an easy pricing situation to understand. And I asked him to just please give us from a sample of 10 municipalities the price at which they bought 80 gram bond copy paper in the previous financial year, which for municipalities obviously ended on the 30th of June. And I was not unsurprised to find out that from the municipality that bought that paper at the lowest price to the highest price, that there was a price difference of 50%. And that brings me to my next question, and that is, the value for money cannot be ignored. While we may have other imperatives and while we need to be aware of the fact that we need to, support smaller enterprises and so on, my impression has always been that it is to support a bigger good and that eventually we want bigger competition in the market. We want to break these monopolies and so on. And then my question is, do you also analyze that kind of a product where you would be able to say to a provincial department, come on, you can buy the same product, and I think that's where the transversal system probably may come in. To what extent do you share the information that you have as part of your database with provincial procurement offices, etc.? And then lastly, I've just come from the Mitchells Plain train station, where we know that our railway system has been hampered by supply chain management problems because of alleged corruption and so on in that sphere. where, for example, some of the security contracts came to an end, and now because we, you know, their supply chain system has come to a, grounded to a halt, now we have massive losses, you know, in other areas, because the criminals now know that there's nobody coming after them for copper theft or arson to trains and so on. So my question is just, to what extent can you also assist provincial departments not to fall into that problem where, for example, some of their procurement processes may fail, and where you can then say, but listen, we can offer, or we know of a way in which you can procure those services within the PFMA and stay within the Auditor General's guidelines, but don't go without those services. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Consul.
Thanks, Chair, and thanks for the presentation. Although I think earlier on I was a bit, you know, lost because it was highly technical, and I am sure you would appreciate that we are not necessarily data specialists ourselves. So sometimes I think it helps to just tone down the information so that we are able to access. Because I was sitting here trying to understand Kato versus this and that, you know. So I think it's imperative to try and locate that within the audience, so that we are not lost in the process. I think in the problem statement, I'm covered, I think, with the latter comment made by the last speaker. In the problem statement, I just want to ask, I think, especially from the systems perspective that you have raised, you indicated the issue of that data integrity as an issue, which I think formulated some of the interventions that we've made. I would like to be interested to check at this point, where are you in terms of the ability with all the interventions to actually, you know, claim, you know, authority or some type of degree of such integrity. And I'm raising this because I think last year when we're dealing with budgets, one of the things that both in terms of provincial government departments, including local government from the AG's point of view, I think one theme that comes across is usefulness of information and accuracy, amongst others. So this begs a question in terms of what has been done and what you are getting after, whether indeed the extent to which your interventions have worked. So in terms of scale, where would you say you are through the interventions that you've made? And then I think on slide 3, in terms of your response plan, which I think for me are some of the issues one would engage in as far as the different departments are concerned, especially along, you know, the overarching PFMA sort of requirements and the triple PFA, which you explained there in terms of the need, you know, a better procurement planning, strategic sourcing, and all of that. Once again, the question is, you being a treasury, you know, you being the budget office, to what extent are we realizing this ideal, you know, of strategic sourcing? Because I'm using an example. One of my questions that I've not actually received a satisfactory answer, especially from the Department of Public Works, is the extent to which you utilize the capital budget to realize the outcomes, as you are depicting here, of strategic sourcing, which is value for money, where you're sitting with the reality that by virtue of contracting with your big contracting companies, which sometimes gets overwhelmed, you know, because the type of packaging of your construction projects are actually at your higher level of your grade 6 to grade 9, and not giving more space
to smaller, that is your grade 1s right up to grade 5 or grade 6 themselves. So in terms of fairness and equitable sourcing, which is required in the triple PFA, you then fall flat because you are trying to say, you know, you are looking for the expertise and all of that. But what we saw is one of the reports was a situation where some of these companies, they could not do the job. They got to be overwhelmed and their cash, you know, become compromised to a point of them being liquidated. And when they're liquidated, it comes back to haunt, you know, the fiscal, in the sense that that was money, those were projects that were needed to be delivered. So once again, my question is the extent to which this information, and I think linked to member that he has raised, the extent to which this information, after you have done all this dashboarding with the intention of, you know, beaming what are the realities, is this influencing practice? Is it influencing behavior? Is it influencing decision making? Because when you sit and you read the AG's report, what you are saying you are having and what we see in the budget and the Auditor General's comments, it seems there is still a long way to go. How long is what I'm interested to know? How long is that road to get to that particular point? And I'm using the example of public works in that regard. Because as you said, what the system helps you is to actually have, as you raise in slide 7, is your early warning system. So early warning for me supposedly helps people to say, you see here, we're not necessarily being strategic, you know, and actually we're not getting a value for money. So those, I think, are my biggest questions in terms of how do we realize this. And because I think the other issue I would want to raise and get, I think, your view as practitioners is the extent to which we all know in the last reports of the AG, one of the things which was raised is the whole notion of deviations. You know, I think they've raised that as an issue. The issue of deviation, the issue of triple BEE, although we're told it's some kind of an issue of a certificate and all of that. How are we, in this financial year going forward, using this system, going to be able to sort of help resolve that particular problem? And my last one, Chair. From slide 10 to slide... what is this one? I think in the examples, I think it's example 5. As I see, as examples that you are showing us here, mine, as a person who may be reading and not sitting in front of the dashboard or the information system that you are exposed to, you see, my limitation is just my comment, is actually what becomes the benchmark. Because if you give me these numbers of the suppliers per regional analysis as an example, I'm asking myself against what? So these numbers against what? So that I'm able to make some kind of an objective analysis to say, yes, we're talking about as a province sitting with about in total, if I'm correct in interpretation of your information, that we've got a total of about 16,654 suppliers that we're doing business with. Against what? How many suppliers do we have that information so that we can justifiably say, indeed, we are maximizing, you know, local procurement in terms of local, if you use utilizing a geography, and versus perhaps, you know, your international companies, including where you're looking at designated groups, which is a good information that we normally ask. But once again, also it becomes important to say, you're saying this against what? Because this is when you're going to be able to see, you know, in the horizon that indeed, you know, this is a drop in the ocean, or actually we are at a point where we're 50% there or less. So I think numbers for me, if I were to utilize them, you know, as that measure that's going to help me to do my oversight, at least must be able to tell me that I'm looking at something against this. So that at least I'm able to make a more justifiable, you know, take out of the numbers. Thanks.
Thank you. I'm going to allow the answers to those questions first, because there are quite a few. Okay.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the questions. I think it's very much, some of those questions are very much close to my own heart. And I think of the Treasury as well in terms of where we want to go. So looking at the first question, I think, okay, I'm gonna answer that last. How do we transition the system into the new? But just to tell you in terms of, I think for this one, we're focusing on the supply chain tool. I'm just going to focus on what we've done on the supply chain tool to the question of what are the changes on the system. So I'm also wanting to now try to be simple on the technical aspects, right, so you understand what I'm saying. So the legacy systems, we're not changing the system per se. There's no configuration on the system per se. People can also assist me with that if I'm saying the right thing. So there's no technical, the system is not being evolved or adapted in a particular way. The same requirements are there. However, we focus on the improvement of input information, input data. How do the users of the system begin to have the necessary discipline, the necessary training, and the capacity to input the information correctly? So for supply chain and even on the broader system, that's a huge focus in the Treasury. So that at that stage, that at the big, from the word go, how do we start improving the information sets on what we have? The BI tool is not a system or a thing that's been created. It's something that is there, and it's a similar, when I spoke about Kitso, it's like kind of what we call the kind of middleware kind of interface or a solution or technical IT tool that begins to pull information in a manner that is consumed to kind of give you the layperson insight. So you don't have to be the technical financial fundi understanding how the accounting requirements are on the BAS system, but being able to, at a layman level, say, okay, how does this information interface? If I want to ask a question of what are we spending on, who we're spending on, and at what commodities, I'm talking to the right thing. All of them are linked to the same commodity. All of the suppliers are captured correctly. The payment information is allocated to the right score classification. So those are the things we're managing in that space. So the focus on credibility and, you know, data integrity. So on the tool itself, if we're pulling through the information and we're looking at duplicates and you know, duplicate information, naming conventions that are not inputted correctly, how do we put the data correction rules up front in the system so that somebody doesn't have to go and manually go and change the thing? So that's what the interface is, to answer your question, on the current system. So there's no real configuration on that. I will leave the second aspect of that question of the readiness that we're dealing with Mr. Mazomba, because his unit is very much involved in the preparation for the new ERP model that may come, which is integrated. Okay, if I could pause there.
Members, thank you very much. I think from the outset, we must apologize, right, for the technical jargon. It's the nature of the environment that we operate in. So I think that's the first thing to mention. I think, secondly, I think the issue, I think, around the integrated financial management system, I think has been something that has been coming for a long time. Right, I think it's something that started, I think, in 2003 already, with National Treasury coming up with an assertion to essentially remove BES, LOGIS, and BESAL into this integrated financial management system, which is still not landed. What we are doing in the province currently is we're working through a strategy to modernize the current systems. It is an important stance to take, because I think after having spent enough time with CFOs and the government departments, it's become quite clear that we do need to have a strategy to essentially then modernize the systems. So this, which Nadia has now presented, is essentially one part of that strategy, which is to essentially take the data that exists in the legacy systems, to make use of that data, right, as raw as it is. And I think it also will cover, to a large extent, remember, your question in terms of whether the integrity of the data that we have there is at a high standard. It is data that, I don't know if you are familiar with the concept of a garbage in, garbage out, right? So government departments essentially have access to these financial systems, or transversal systems, personal basis, whether it's locus. The intention behind it is for them to actually carry on administration, right? And the reason why we build these financial systems is because we want to derive data out of it. However, the data is presented, right? So it may be that the integrity of it is not as high standard as what we want to be. It is about the user that essentially then inputs that data onto the system. So I think that part, I think, needs to essentially then be covered. So in terms of then going back on the modernization strategy, our view is that we want to make use of the legacy systems and essentially then put a layer, a technical layer on top, which I think earlier on was alluded to by Nadia, which is a middleware layer, right, which will essentially integrate the financial systems with a newer interface, which will assist government departments with other things, like a typical example, leave, as things stand, is being submitted manually. There's a paper that goes from one person to another. That paper can get missing in the process. Right? Now, how do we digitize that to enable us to keep track and actually administer in a proper way? So the modernization strategy is meant to actually digitize some of these areas. Now, rightfully, I think my colleague had mentioned that BI, or business intelligence, is not a system, but in actual fact, it is a place at which we take all the data, store in one central place, and essentially then, like a miner would, mine the data, right, to pull out things that we require to give a feedback on. So as a typical example, if you look at what has been submitted, I think in slide 10 and so forth, this is what actually comes from the system. It is that data, right? It is data that gives us those early warning signs to say, look at this data firstly. Is it correct? That's the first part. The second part is then it is meant to change behavior, right, at ensuring that when we saying that we pick up that a piece of a loaf of bread is 50 rand, something is wrong with that, right? It's either it's the data that's wrong, or it's the manner of approach in terms of procuring that particular data that's causing that. So I think those are the things that I wanted to pick up in terms of the questions that have been raised. There might be other questions which Nadia will cover.
So thank you, Apiwa. I think you've covered some of the specifically on the systems aspect, and you've also went into some of the thinking around that. Just to look at some of the questions I think Member West Aiden raised in terms of easy pricing, how do we look at value for money, how do we look at the greater good in competition. So look, you haven't got all of the views. There's much more dashboarding. I think it touches on the question that Member raised on the aspects around how do you look at supplies against what baseline. So important in the information set is the supply information. Unfortunately, I didn't put that slide into the examples, but the slides come from a bigger report. So when you look at slide 10, for example, or slide 11, it is against slide 11 would be the baseline would be 30% procurement to companies that are be owned. So the question, when I put this slide for cabinet at that stage, and they say 30% subcontracting. Now, the question that I'm raising here, the 30% subcontracting, this is primary purchasing. Without even subcontracting, we are achieving the targeted aim of empowerment, which is 30%, 51% black-owned companies. So subcontracting becomes where we say we use a scientific approach, and to that is an addition, we look at an empowerment impact assessment tool. So built in the procurement planning, when you're in the planning stage already, you begin to look at the supplier database, which is the Western Cape region, almost 16,000 or more, depending on whether they're compliant within our own evidence bank. And then in the national space, it's far and wide. I don't know, apparently up here, if you know the stats of what there is, the last time I checked it was about 135,000 going upward. So that was a year ago when I checked that stat. I checked the report on what the current volume is. But it's moving consistently, you know, across. And so within the baseline, we look at what is within the Western Cape, and within the report I can show you that information. If I take you through the system, we would know exactly what we've been purchasing. So even in terms of the expenditure, it would be against our budget, and then the regional spread, the supplier spread, the department spread, who are the suppliers per commodity, per region, per BE status. So you can get a whole host of information. It all depends what are you asking the information to give you. That's why I said the self-service on the fly model that we use. If you ask that question while I'm sitting in front of the live system, I can pull out that information for you, you know, as we go along. So that was the question three. Then the value for money aspect is, I think, some of the unintended consequences, and I'm going to answer this question about unit costing and how do we begin to look. So Apiwe dealt with some of it, that we can actually see inefficiencies, but then how do we respond to it? One of the transversal contracting model, the framework contracting models, are some of the things that are there in the procurement space that can create the opportunities for improvements, efficiencies, consolidation of spend, looking at companies that you can purchase differently. And when I say transversal contracting, I do not mean consolidating 13 departments and the winner takes it all. So you get one monopoly being created. So the model of creating frameworks, panel contracts, and those kind of things become critical in how you look at socioeconomic empowerment. But it also comes at a risk. A good example of that risk is the security contract that we're currently putting on the province, where we're being legally challenged on. You have one judgment that is sitting that I have on record where they wanted to do an urgent application to court. And the judgment is saying that they have not seen such an efficient way of dealing with things. That if government needs to look at its burden of spend in the tight fiscus, these are the kinds of things we need to look at. But the question also is the supplier market ready for that? Are these smaller, other bigger companies willing to accept that they're not going to get winner takes it all? The second question is, when you actually look at this broader spend, there's less work for certain people. And because everybody's vying for work. And everybody's worrying about the bottom dollar and being an effective contributor in the economy and earning and having that earning capacity. So it's tough times and it's a difficult space that we find ourselves. And when you actually have the initiative, then the question, the barometer is the legal challenge the barometer for whether or not this was a viable option in terms of government imperatives? You know, because the public is up in, you know, arms, or the supplier community is up in arms, because I, who had a contract over six companies in the past that dealt with security in the province, and we monopolized the environment, and I got 120 million worth of contract, but now I'm getting 60 million and I'm not happy with it. So it's like those kind of conversations that become critical, and eventually we have a perspective in how we present that information to you. So that's one of the examples. So, but looking at unit costing, there are some challenges on the system. So we can very much get that on the current e-procurement system. So as it relates to, the lower value procurement, we're moving to the point of getting the bigger purchasing, where you could have this on a system, so the data is there as a field of capture. So you can pull unit costing in and begin to look at some of the things. Because the unintended consequence sometimes of empowerment is about the premiums that are built in. So when you build a premium and you don't have a baseline, so the question of baseline comes in, an acceptable baseline is on the preferential procurement, then anything, even 100% to 150% premium can be built in, and it creates inefficiencies and disempowerment. And then it comes to the other question of companies going bust or government spending too much when it could have actually had efficiency gain. So those are some of the technicalities that we're dealing with on the purchasing model. And when we're implementing our procurement planning tool, the data mining tool, how do we complement this and begin to look at how we make this available to our departments in a way that they can consume the information and be able to influence their decision making going forward? How do we build on that continuously? So I get to the point that I can tell you, if I'm building a school, I'll know what each of those things cost per school, per item, per classroom, even going down to the bill of quantities and the bill of materials. Now they do that, but it's also in a format that's in the BID document. But are we seeing that on a system that I can say, okay, I built this school in that area and this school in the other area, but how do I match that and how do I take the market objectives in terms of supply and demand, region, and get efficiencies, and what are the baselines against which I'm operating? So it's quite a involved, technical, difficult space, but where we can, particularly on the goods and services space, it's a little bit easier than on a construction space, because you're dealing with different players in the market. You're dealing with the bigger companies monopolizing. You're also dealing with some of the government objectives where I'm going to use infrastructure as the lever. And then how do you bring new entrants in the market? And when you're actually dealing with them, are you setting them up for failure? And how do we have these support programs that go along? So there's a number of composite things that play in that space to create sustainability in the space. And the models that are currently there have proved to be quite contentious ones. They work in some instances and they don't in others. And then the question is, do we have the correct visibility? Are we asking the right questions? So from value for money perspective, I can't tell you honestly, with all certainty, we're achieving the targets that we're wanting to, but we're getting there. The insight that we get from the system or what we've implemented thus far allows us to get the level of perspective as a treasury and for provincial departments. So I'm going to answer some of the questions interrelate with each other. So the information is made available quarterly to the departments. We track procurement planning, we assess the reports, and we engage with the departments on a quarterly basis regularly. We partner with them consistently, so it's not, we're moving from this them and us kind of thing, because the Treasury always being perceived as the watchdog or the oversight body, and it's a them, and then we become like the AG, so it's always an attack on that. But we've moved away from that space long ago. Whilst there is a level of respect for Treasury oversight, but there's also, if we need to become a partner, how do we collectively improve to the common goals that is addressed in the VIP? You'll find the current VIP 5 places a particular attention on commodity analysis and initiatives on the procurement space. So some of the questions that you've asked is very much related to what we're going to now focus on. We're ready to move to the next level, and we're ready to improve on some of the things. But we needed to be in the space where we understood our own gaps and our own dilemmas and the own risks within the supply chain space, and how do we deal with that optimally going forward. How do we deal with failures? I think failures are also, it's about, is your failure, and I think my HOD asked this question to me when he was appointed, and he says, how do we look at failures not as an irregular expenditure or a fruitless and wasteful expenditure consideration? And if we measure something that has not worked right, always in terms of what the audit outcome is there learning and is there improvement, and how do we change the conversation in a space and time to look at service delivery and performance in a different way? And I think it's some of the things that we're wanting to do with also the service delivery index and all of those things that are currently in the VIP. But how do we change the behavior to begin to see that? What has happened in the procurement space is risk aversion to make decisions as well, because you have a complex procurement governance and rule-driven environment that forces people in a particular space, and they're driven by what I call the clean audit syndrome. So if the clean audit is what drives you, then the efficiencies and having to do things differently becomes questionable, especially if the AG does not accept this kind of innovation, and how far do the rules allow for an innovative approach in transacting? Because there are a number, and I'm going to go to the AG question, and I think we've covered some of it in our previous standing committee engagements where I gave you the list of issues and the list of things that become impractical, irrational, and unimplementable in the supply chain space. And we need to have a balance on what is real issues of non-compliance or municipal interference or corruption issues or deliberate wrongdoing. And we also need to balance it out. What is it that are interpretive of nature? What is it where we're really struggling with the problem, like BEE certification, local content implementation, the whole aspect of Regulation 32 in the municipal space, composition of bid committees, and those kind of things that impact on service delivery, and what was the intent of the legislation in that space, because we're sitting with the problem, particularly on the municipal space, in how some of those interpretations has landed in the audit report. Now, in our engagements with the AG, what the AG is saying, and the AG is not incorrect, so the question is, lots of us attack the AG, but the problem is not the AG, the problem is with us. So how do we begin as a province to influence the national government or national treasury to change some of that regulatory environment? And I think in this year, around the 4th or 5th of February, we have raised this, HOD has raised this with the TCF at the national space, and almost forced an engagement where we're sitting with the national treasury in flagging. We've given them a matrix of issues. Almost a 30-40 page document of all of the issues, now some of which I've presented at a high level to this committee. I've given you that on the provincial space, but we've augmented that and also capturing some of the comments and the issues that are in the audit report of municipalities and departments. And we now want to systematically deal with that with the national community. Also supporting them the platform to engage with us and give them assistance. Because some of the things we've gotten right here, but when you're dealing with the National Treasury as well, they've got 9 provinces. And because when you're dealing with instructions at 9 provinces, you have to look at what's wrong with the national perspective. And they're in a difficult position on how to correct the wrongdoing. So those are some of the things that we've invited them to partner with us and how we can actually change some of those. Some of which there's a lot of low-hanging fruit that you can actually very quickly amend and look at the prescripts that are dealing with problems that are in the instruction or circular level. The legislative level is a bigger, it's a longer-term kind of thing where you need to now look at amendment of legislation to deal with that. But obviously we're going to sit with a program that we're going to deal with the national treaty. So the extent to which we look at how, the AXA reports are reflective of performance of supply chain needs to be contextualized. And I think the important question is, how do we get this committee to see what we see? And what are the real problems that are sitting with the municipality, and what of those are as a result of, how do you report on the annual financial statements? Is it necessary non-compliant? Is it about this requirement not working in time space? And there are aspects of a counselor doing wrongdoing or doing mischief. How do we begin to deal with that in the way that we ought to be doing as a treasury and our partnerships with the Department of the Premier on the provincial side and the Department of Local Government on the local side? So those are some of the governance mechanisms that we've built in. So you have the joint working group on the local side, you have the governance platform with the Department of the Premier that the governance cluster departments work in to be able. So although the supply chain is a treasury kind of competence that we look at from a finance perspective, it's important also to look at the culture behavior aspects that are sitting with our two governance cluster departments as well, and how do we deal with departments and municipalities differently. Then what have I missed out? Okay, so the cash compromise, I think I've covered it a little bit, but very briefly. When you're dealing with companies that, when you're looking at empowerment, so for example, you do sit with looking at the BEE context and whatever, the unintended consequences, when you sometimes allocate work in terms of nominal compliance without looking at sustainability of the supplier at the smaller level and their capacity to deliver. The unintended consequence is sometimes their ability to deliver and being liquidated. They also, their pricing model in what becomes sustainable from a procurement. And we've seen this happen. We've even seen big companies go bust. It's an unintended consequence of the regulatory requirement on the triple PFA, because you're talking about subcontracting. It's prescribed on the BEE Act and how these things must be dealt with. I think without actually understanding what the consequences of that would be on the market. So it's a big problem that we're sitting with. And you can see some of those things, but also how do we work with the Department of Trade and Industry as well as the National Treasury when we're prescribing these things, so that they're more practical, they're thought through well, and they're rational. Because sometimes, more often than not in the supply chain space, what we find is that something sounds theoretically logical, but when you're looking at the practical implementation, it's not that straight line logic as a layperson that we would apply. So when we put a piece on the table, when we speak to the people that are at the grassroots level, and how they implement, it becomes a different picture. So I think the partnering and how we deal with departments and municipalities is critical. And those are some of the things that we're looking at. The soft, how do you begin? If a PWA is sitting in the Department of Health and his work is dealt with, procurement is dealt with in a particular way, how do I, as the legislative requirement within the Treasury, begin to partner with Apiwe to make his life easier so that it's real, his delivery becomes impactful. And those are some of the things that we're doing. Then the reverse of that is when you're dealing with not just departments, and you need to prescribe and put out your purchasing in a particular way to approach the market, the question is the market ready for that? So in that perspective, a huge focus on supplier development. How do we as a Treasury begin to look at the supplier base that we do business with and build a level of competency there? Also, for them to understand the shrinking fiscus, because the market has to not also be totally dependent on government purchasing, because that's an unsustainable model in the economy. They also need to become sustainable business, but how do we change that? Because the history tells us that companies have depended on government to be sustainable in certain commodities. So what is the focus on building that competence and capability? And we partner with our Department of Economic Development and the national government as well to see how do we begin to change this economy. It's a difficult one. And I'm not going to commit to the fact that this may work. But you have to learn and do and try different things in the space. So the Treasury in this year, in the new financial year, we'll be launching what we call the client a public-facing client walk-in center. We never named it yet. It's the process of it being launched post the budget, in which municipalities, departments, and suppliers can engage in the procurement environment. And how do we create that learning across the three components that deal within the supply chain space to improve procurement in the manner that we want to. I don't know if you can highlight. I think I've answered most of it. But if I haven't, please you can ask me again if I need to direct me to that which I haven't.
Thank you. Any follow-ups? Honorable Nkondlo, Honorable Van der Westhuizen.
Chair, whilst I appreciate the response, and perhaps we agree that some of the issues that we are debating here are really matters that have feedback of the public health ecosystem. I'm listening, and I think you are raising very important issues or nuances of the supply chain management in context, you know, to a bigger environment, as you call it, the supplier market. Then I ask my question in that and the unintended consequences that would be responsibility, you know, because obviously government has
got a particular role to facilitate market participation. Whether at a particular point in time, that's part of business, that's why it's got competition laws, that then markets themselves must raise themselves to respond. Less government is viewed taking a particular buyer to a particular competing market. And I think that this is the nuance, I think, which is what I was picking from what you are raising, not necessarily responding specifically on the kind of issues that I'm raising, or you are then, you know, in a way exposing us
to some of the realities of the supplier environment as you beam it against,
you know,
what are the impacts to those
suppliers that are required because we need service at the end of the day. You know, when I want to say, you know, because at this point people need houses, so you sit with that particular
reality and you sit with a choice that needs to be made through a contracting mechanism. But I think, for me, Chair, these are continuous conversations. But one particular one that I think it may not necessarily be responded to at this point is the whole notion of the communication that you are speaking about. Because at some point, I think Member Vestazen makes the reference. Remember, outside there is a particular perception about government procurement system, that it is corrupt, politicians are corrupt, and all of that. And the AG is one tool that enables an ordinary person, you know, to understand or interpret whether a government is working or not. And once there, I mean, there is a little or a very minimal understanding of the complexities. So until at some point, and I'm speaking now, you know, narrowly, as a politician myself, I can't be sitting in an environment where my being and my credibility is questioned on the basis that, you know, from a communication broader perspective, there is this thing, because when somebody reads and into the report, you know, and finds irregular expenditure, you can complicate it all you want with a technical jargon. But the reality of what has been communicated to South Africa to this point, and we are all responsible for that, whether it's in the design, you know, or in the challenges of how regulations are developed, the reality of the matter is that there is somebody, and now
the entire system, including media,
has ramped up people to the point that somebody must take the responsibility. If then there was somebody, Nomi's name must be there, that Nomi did or activated the irregular expenditure.
So somehow we become unfair to the system if we then sit with the comfort of this very complicated conversation, because this is a standing committee and actually it's a public a process. If an ordinary person was sitting here, you would
find him or herself, you know, very lost in this particular conversation of what exactly is happening, who is responsible, where exactly is the problem. But I am quite okay with the kind of responses that you are giving, because you are then signaling to us the challenges of the bigger system, including, I think, the list that you have already submitted. And I think I commend those engagements that you guys are having with a treasury, because that's NDPI treasury in particular, because we raised that during the corporate engagement. But somehow, we can't be speaking about something that is in the sky, because at the end of the day, we need to go back to the public and be able to simplify where is the problem, you know. So I want to appreciate that, and I just wanted to raise that, Chair, and to agree with, I think, the latter statement you made about the fact that, unfortunately, the nature of our democracy, including our financial system, is a learning tool, you know, and it is not necessarily prescribed anywhere, because you're dealing with a particular history that you have to address. So I think somehow, I personally would be able to ask my questions now with the comfort that you do have the information. So no official is going to come here and say, we can't, you know, pull out that information, because you have indicated with this data mining, data dashboarding, that actually somebody, if I ask a question specifically, you know, about suppliers,
that information is available. At least, Chair, from that point,
that empowerment from me personally as a member has happened through
this particular process. Because then it links us to the next conversation we're going to have about inequality, because
that is what is the glaring picture on how we utilize the way in which we do business in the manner to respond to that reality.
Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable
Sarbeza.
Chair, I'll try and be brief, because I've
given
this report
so much. That's
such
an
I'm
not sure.
reluctant to serve on bit education and graduation committees because they fear they might be adversely liable, and membership of those committees may not have been part of their job descriptions when they applied for their jobs, etc. And is that a real fear? Is that something which we should address in one or other way? The second one is the whole issue of a long-term relationship with suppliers versus the open competition that, you know, sounds so beautifully. I do know that, for example, vehicle manufacturers often have such a long-term relationship with the suppliers of certain parts that they even have internet connections, direct or dedicated internet connections, because there's also something called just-in-time. You know, if I manufacture a car's body, I need this dashboard or panel tomorrow, and you need to start working on it. And that is the need for efficiency that drives that long-term relationship. Now, to what extent does the PFMA allow us to also go into certain long-term contracts? And I can just think something like such as security, the monitoring of security cameras and so on requires a longer, people need to know where the cables are, where the cameras are, etc. And then the last one is, and my apologies if I've missed it, but I've recently myself experienced this. We felt that the supplier has let us down. It's very difficult to prove it. It was for the distribution of goods and so on. And if it was my own business, I wouldn't use that supplier again. Now, to what extent can we also, I don't want to say red flag certain suppliers, because the moment the supplier is going to find out that an official has red flagged him, you know, that supplier can approach probably a court of law and say, you know, I'm now being discriminated against and so on. But I will definitely not, if it's, as far as it's in my power, support that supplier again. And sometimes the measure of service is not that easy to pin down. You know, it's like a caterer. You can have two caterers. The one puts the food, the same volume of food or the same specs, but the one's plate looks beautifully, and the other one, you know, is just the food has just been put in front of you, etc. How do we distinguish in terms of procurement between those intangible kind of levels of service?
Find out, how do you deal with coincidences in the system? Because some people, based on whichever belief they may have a belief that a coincidence is a remarkable concurrence of events or circumstances based on an apparent causal connection. My own view is that coincidences are based on probability theory. And if you look at, for example, the birthday problem, anytime you have a group of 23 or more people, the ability of two people having a birthday rises above 50%. So in my own organization, we have 24 people. So, for example, Honorable Mitchell and myself have a birthday on the same date. And in the organization that are WCPP, there's 42 people. So I'm going to find out, have you found coincidences in the system? If so, were they an apparent causal connection? How do you deal with those particular types of coincidences within the system? You can take mine last, because I just really want to run to the bathroom.
I'm going to try to be brief, because we can have these conversations in depth further, if should there be anything else. I don't want to take the airtime of my other colleagues as well. So in terms of the first question on the reluctance of bid committees, it is a very real problem. It's in Oudtshoorn, in the West Coast District, where I'm just coming out of a time engagement. A number of the municipalities are saying they're not going to. So it's come to the point where it's affecting service delivery, because procurement is not going by the committee anymore. So they're not being able, because it's going to be non-compliant, according to the AG, if at least these four senior managers within the executive leadership of the municipality are sitting on the BID committee. So there's an interpretation of whether that should constitute the supply chain person and whether the supply chain person has to be a senior, is it a senior official or is it a senior management? And there's questions around the Systems Act and the municipal space. It was one of the red flag issues that we put on number one on the priority list for the OCP office when we had the engagement with the National Treasury. In fact, yesterday we were, and today we're trying to have a further engagement because the incumbent is at Parliament now, meeting with the, from the OCP office, actually giving feedback on SEM performance. So we're wanting to flag that and to look at a mechanism. They did raise, they just say there would be an interpretation, the National Treasury will issue an instruction on that. So we're wanting to actually fast track that because right now it's impacting on service delivery. By the end of the week or so, we should see whether that actually resolves the issue. And similarly on the BE issue and certificate, I think that was also one of the questions that I didn't answer because there's a whole lot of, I answered it generically. It's one of those that's also been red flag and decisions taken at the PAG forum. Long-term relationships versus open competition. The PFMA doesn't outlaw long-term contracts. They do have what in Section 66 that needs to, any commitment against the revenue fund needs to go via process. Similarly, there's a Section 33 requirements on the municipal side, on the MFMA side, that needs to go to council. However, there's also a court decision that says it doesn't apply to procurement. So now we need to review what does that mean, where the MEC doesn't need to apply a future commitment because it's still a commitment against the revenue fund. So you can go for longer term contracts. But I think it also needs to be looked at in perspective because when you're looking at 217 of the Constitution and the way the Constitution is written, as well as the socioeconomic aspects of it, it's about creating the opportunity for more people to enter the fray in the market. And longer-term contracts generally have the tendency to keep a company longer in the process. And then the question would be, what would be the challenge from the market in terms of having those longer-term contracts? Particularly in the ICT environment, ICT is a commodity. You can't be changing systems every 3 years if that's within the end. For example, the e-procurement system, we've managed over 20 years in the province, you know, up until now, where we're going and we're changing. So, and that is because you can't be chopping and changing when you have a system that works for you. It's about keeping that, but then the unintended consequence is creating a monopoly. And you know, companies happening there. So what is the balance on how to deal with that? And I think usually when we deal with it from a treasury side, it's on a case-by-case basis. Because when they're dealing with departments, dealing with, particularly on the department side, because they come to the treasury with business cases for longer-term contracts, they come to the treasury in terms of looking at limited bidding for longer-term and those kinds. So we look at the due diligence and have you put through, have you tested the market appropriately? Is the supplier the right one? What is the, you know, in terms of continuity and sustainability and improvement, the capacity to deliver? What is the impact of this decision? So we look at various things, and there have been instances, particularly you'll find the biggest departments have had instances where they're doing the longer-term contracting within the confines. It's not so acceptable from an AG perspective because the first thing that they will attack you, as well as from the national perspective. So having your ducks in a row and being able to justify decision-making is critical in any space. And it would bring me to the question that the other member asked us on, you know, how do you begin to look at, I think it's the last question, and how do you look at coincidences as well? And it's about evidence-based practice. So we're pushing that model very well because it's also a thin line between over introducing over controls, too much, and over regulating, but it's also about how do you document and begin to record, have a record of decisions that supports decision making. So within the Western Cape government, we have what you call the accounting officer system for supply chain, which, and I think we operate in what we call within the auspices of PAJA, just administrative action. So the accounting officer system is written in the context of PAJA. So whether you're in demand management, whether you're in spec, whether you, as how you approach the market, you need to have a strategy and all of those things that influence the decision making. Coincidences is one of the means we use to pick up exceptions. So when we're doing the kind of data mining, coincidences is the first thing when you do your pick up your samples in investigating any system that you, because it's kind of it's a positive and a negative thing, because you can pick it up and you can see that it's just a coincidence. It's happened, but there's a proper thought process that. So for us, it's about looking at those things. So we use coincidences to actually plan of things that may come up in the supply chain, but it's with an investigation, not an investigation with forensics, but applying ourselves in the decision tree. So it's a decision tree kind of assessment before we actually, go to the hardline approach with the department. And the department needs to account, because we raise that what we do is what we call the budget cycle assessment. That process, when things are there, how come supplier X is keep getting the contract? And you have sometimes it's really a problem, because in a private sector space, you're rationalizing a supply base. So a private sector company would look at the bottom dollar and say, I can choose who I do business with. Yes, I'm simulating competition, but I need to develop a relationship with the supplier who is best suitable to give effect to my business model. So they will rationalize it. Government is doing the opposite, because we're looking at our other policy imperatives that come. So we're going this way. More people coming in, and a perception that when a supplier is too long in the system with a department, there's something untoward happening. Because if you're dealing with a company that's dealing with your something with you, and delivering on infrastructure delivery for the last 15, 20 years, it's a red flag for some other kind of question because of the administrative challenges that needs to. So it's a difficult space, and it's a difficult question. But we deal with some of those on a case-by-case basis. What is the evidence saying? What is the rationale and the reasoning for decision-making? And can the accounting officer justify his decision? And if we have documented that, then that's what we present to the AG in support of the department and as a treasury. There has been an issue where should they take cognizance of what the provincial treasury is saying, as opposed to what the national, and there has been that conflict where they find that the provincial treasury doesn't have that space to actually regulate on the procurement. It's a national treasury competence. But we've gone into what the requirements are in the PFME, and I think there is this understanding, but obviously that further engagement where some of these things need to change. Then I think the one that I didn't answer yet is the red flagging. That's also on poor performance. So one of the things that we're doing is how do we begin to look at, before we red flag, is something innately wrong with the system, the supplier consistency, poor performance, and the So a root cause analysis of what is the problem. Is it about contract management? Is it about our contracts not being responsive enough to holding a supplier accountable? What are the performance issues that need to be in the contract? So a huge contract management focus, both at the municipal and provincial level, to the point we're doing training capacity. I mean, our PVN team has just gone through contract management training in the Treasury, for example, and how we deal with it. AG also having a strong emphasis, where we absolutely agree with them, and how do you look at these models differently? Are they the necessary controls? And then when we go to red flag, now that is another aspect of how we're finding problems as well. The National Treasury has requirements where they put things on the database. So somebody who has not performed, there's two databases, there's a database of restricted suppliers, and there's a database of tender defaulters. And you can, as a province, step it, and a supplier can be restricted from doing business over 5 to 10 year period. However, the controls within which that operate is problematic. So the moment you put something on a website, from a legal perspective, if it's wrong, and you've actually maligned the supply in a way, the first requirement for defamation has been fulfilled because it's been published. So you're sitting with some of those challenges. The other is, what is the due diligence that is there before you actually put it on? Because if it's based on a truth and it's based on things that have happened, you know, can you defend the fact that it's made public? So we work in two mechanisms of that, one of which is, how do we red flag on the supplier database, some of those things, so you can, we're working on creating that functionality on the supplier database. So in flight, as we work with suppliers, what are the things that they are red flagging so that our departments can see that? Departments within the province have restricted suppliers by an accounting officer. So that's well within the legal framework. An accounting officer can say, I don't want to do business with you on those X, Y, and Z reasons, provided that you have the evidence to do that and it's within, and you're not influencing the decision of other, because then it becomes a mass kind of thing and it could be unfair labor, unfair practices, or whatever those issues may be. But it's very sensitive, and I don't think we are at that level of maturity that we can do some of these things. Because even the Combating Corrupt Activities Act has a special requirement in the Act that deals with how the National Treasury must manage that database. And the tender defaulters database was built in that context. However, there's a whole number of disclaimers everywhere. It's not updated. And when you go to court, now one of the requirements in the tender defaulters list is asking for the court to, in its judgment, make a judgment again for the supplier to be listed on this database. And if the court hasn't, there's always this open room are you compliant with the requirements of that section in the Combating Corrupt Activities Act? So the accountable, and it's about all of the procurement, that's all over the media, is it about the accountability? It's about how are we holding people accountable? Are we building the necessary requirements? And are we following through on some of that? So when a supplier doesn't perform, do we document, do we notify them? Because the law says, if somebody is doing wrong and you don't tell them about it, you've accepted the bad behavior, you can't at the end go and cancel and you find yourself in a contract law problem when you go to court. But if you've actually placed them on terms in what they call in law and you consistently monitor that, it's about managing that relationship better. So it's a very involved conversation of where and how that needs to be done. There has been things built in the legal framework. But whether or not we've applied them in the manner that we should is the question. And I think even for us, we're struggling with some of that, but we're hoping to find a common ground. And I think the question on communication, I think I didn't answer that even a bit. Oh, that was the first question on the comeback. Communication is what we're bad at. And you're absolutely right in when you say that what the public sees and do they understand the context of what you're sitting with this bigger picture. And when they see irregular expenditure, they equate it to corruption. The moment you have irregular expenditure in your annual report, it's already in the media. The AG is making a briefing on that. And when we speak up as an organ of state, do we give the right context? And even if we give that context, are we just taking the AG on? And it shouldn't be about taking the AG on. And so, for me, I see a big lacuna, a gap, in how we communicate. And how do we start doing this more responsibly and then, you know, actually getting the right focus? Because it's something that we're bad at doing. And the public will perceive how they would perceive it. Because the layperson, it's about the taxpayers' money. It's about service delivery and what they're getting at the end of the day. They see something not happening at grassroots level. It's about something going wrong. What did you do with the money that's allocated to you? So those kind of questions very much come into the fore, and I think communication, this has come through from our current DG as well, how do we communicate in a different way that the public begins to see what we're busy with? How do we involve public participation in a different way? How do we give a redress to some of those things? And we're hoping to achieve that. I don't have the solution to it, but we need to start trying to do that differently. Otherwise, it's going to be forever something that's going to be at loggerheads with the good governance principles that we aspire to achieve.
Thank you.
Yes, I just wanted to add
So I think on the comment by Member Gondra, I just want to add that and your question as well. Because I think in broad it's about systems as well. So when I joined Treasury, one of the things that I looked at was specifically around the data and the systems. Broadly, I saw a sea of data that I thought they could actually take together, mesh together, and make some good insights out of it. By doing so, we established what we call the data enablement team. So that data enablement team is actually meant to assist the Treasury, to assist Western Cape government, the 13 departments, in terms of what it is that they require at any given point in time for the assistance data of that logis, as well as that. I think that's what I want to bring there. Secondly, I think coincidentally, funny enough, just the other day, one of my assistant directors walked into my office, he's Eric. They see two doctors, same similar ID number, same surname, right? Same credentials in terms of date of birth, etc., etc. So they say this could be a duplication. We're paying double to this doctor. Only to find out that in actual fact these are twins. These are twin doctors. The point I'm raising to it is that we have within that data enablement unit a capability to monitor on a daily basis, a report on a monthly basis in terms of the activities that we see there on BESAL, on BES, as well as on logis, right? It is to track activities, right? It is to also, as part of oversight mandate, to give that feedback back to the departments in terms of what we see. We do host quarterly engagements, which are meant to actually give this kind of feedback to the departments in terms of trends of what we see. Not saying that you're baddie, but we're saying this is what we're seeing on the system. So I'm trying to bring those points across. So we do have those kind of things as well that come through. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for being so comprehensive as well. Unfortunately, we've also gone into some of the other time. Thank you so much. I'm going to give a 5 minutes comfort break before we come back for the next presentation. I'm just going to encourage members just to keep on the next presentation with their questions or comments short, please. Thank you. We will then reconvene at 11:42.
Okay. Staff and I jump every day.
You offer me? And you've been okay?
Yeah. I couldn't fit into this jacket the last time I saw it. And I fit into it now. And you see with my body now, it's like, when I pick up weight, I pick up weight, like, expand. I don't just pick up in one place. So it's almost like I just get bigger. I don't like just get
like a balloon.
Like my face is like
becoming. But I was
going to
say, like,
for
guys,
so it's maybe a good thing also, the leap of absence and stuff like that.
It's good thing also just for mental
health. Yeah, I also think
so. I just want to give me a yoga.
Apply for position at PMG also.
What's it?
Content and communications officer. Because the stuff that they said was like, it was stuff that I've done before.
Are
like
you right for people
with women? Is that difficult to work?
No, I launched people with women.
Really?
And I interact.
Yo, don't you want to write me motivation?
No,
I mean,
I don't know.
Don't
I
you want to
write?
Don't you want to add me there as a reference, like, worked with me so professional?
I mean, like, you can add me as a reference or work with me as a reference, and we can speak.
Don't secretly, just check it.
Sure, I'd like if he phones that.
This here, this is what I made. So, I did this, right? So, I made this one CV. Just a cover page, man. Right. And then, this is the actual CV.
Oh, wow, that's nice.
See, because I put the emails here. Then I was an admin assistant or so. And I, obviously there's 2 pages, man. Them in languages, English, Afrikaans, French, Spanish. I put working knowledge, you know, because it's not like I'm native in it, man.
Oh, you're not like fluent.
Yeah, but I've learned it at the tertiary level already, so. Like, I can speak.
Can you do that conversation?
Yeah. Then? Like, je m'appelle Mubin. Je suis étudiant.
Okay, like basic.
Not like basic, like I can have a conversation and I can understand you if you talk to me. But it's not like where I'm gonna be like, writing out a report on this shit. Do you know what I mean? And then I put here legal assistant for ACES, Bachelor of Law. I even put here, because here I'm doing these courses, man, at UCT, you know, the paralegal practitioner one, and the professional communication. Yeah. And the professional communication and office management work.
But you guys will know all each other counter on that.
I even put here.
But do we actually go over?
I mean, I even put here, like, opinion writer for Media 24 and mentor and...
Look, you've got the writing experience, that's obvious. I think it's going to come down more to... Like, they can obviously tell that you can write, they can...
It's going to maybe come down to...
So the content is fine, you could obviously... you're obviously one of those people who can think of something to write to be creative in that way. I think it's going to come down to personality stuff, man. Like, who they can think is, so you'll be in the office 5 days a week, basically.
Do they pay well?
And that's going to be the problem. No, they never pay. You see, after I left, they started implementing, like, certain, like, benefits. Because they then they needed a retention strategy, because when I left, I was the only person working on people for 10 days. Literally all the back-end stuff, all... Like the most of the content, etc. That was all me. I think even when I went on holiday, I was in Morocco for a month. I was working, I was updating a website from Morocco.
Yeah.
And then like, so after I left, then they did like more of a retention strategy, I could say. And now there's, and I think I told them, you need to start thinking like, what if National Parliament moves Pretoria? What do you do?
Was it like more than 10k?
Down, okay?
Was it more than 10k?
Yeah, but it took me like years.
10k.
I've worked for PMG for like...
No, but was it, I mean like when you were permanent.
Where you can.
I mean like when you were permanent.
It was more than 10k.
Like when you started.
I'm trying to think I think it was when I ended maybe about 10k. But the thing is, I don't know how much they pay now. And that one was for me completely running the website. They might be very difficult.
This one says run the website.
But how much for them to put the salary on?
But they say they want somebody with 1 to 2 years experience. But clearly,
so
they
like
I do
very,
have experience.
Like, but then you need to ask Rashad, like, if I were you, I'd inquire and be like, you know, what's the salary like? Is it negotiable?
Yeah.
Because I would definitely negotiate now, but like back then, that was my only work experience right out of university.
And mine is decent.
Yeah, and mine was like, I left university, I immediately started interning a part-time and then interning the next year, and then I was like a senior intern in the office, and then they hired me to do like all parts of the week. I was like a good governance coordinator, a writer, and I was for People's Assembly also a project coordinator, etc.
Okay.
So that's like looking for entry level, but what I which kind of reasons you have?
Yeah.
But
okay.
I would find out about
that. Do you think that like I'm an opinion writer for media journalism is a good thing?
Thank you everyone for holding back. We're going to continue with the next presentation in hard copy while we're obviously with the electronic. So the next presentation, as you'll see, is Inequality Trends in South Africa, a multidimensional diagnostic of inequality. Thank you for the Western Cape Treasury also again for being here, the budget office specifically. I know it's not your document, but thank you for putting all of the statistics and the analysis together for us for today. Members, we're going to jump right in, and then afterwards I'll open up for questions. If we can just keep our questions and comments succinctly. Please just give us a broad overview of what is going on in this report. We did get the documentation beforehand as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Myself and my colleague, Nupashi, is going to do the presentation. I'm going to do the first half and she will do the second half. So we tried to take this 200-page document and condense it in less than 50 slides. We're going to do the background to the study, the motivation for the study, the structure for the study, and the key findings for the study. And Nupashi will conclude with the main results again. On the introduction side, Stats SA released a report last year, the 14th of November 2019. This was the first time that Stats SA released this report. The report is a partnership between Stats SA, the Southern African Labour Development Research Unit, or SALDRU, the French Agency for Development, or AFD, and the African Centre of Excellence for Inequality Research, or ACER. The primary data sources for the report is the Income and Expenditure Survey, the Condition Survey, the General Household Survey, and the Quarterly Labour Force Survey. The other data sources, which is from the UCT, is the National Income Dynamics Study and the Post-Apartheid Labour Market Series. On the next slide, the background to the report is that inequality in South Africa is the most salient feature of the country. In SA, it's ranked as the most unequal country in the world. In most reports by most organizations, SA is the top country in terms of inequality. In addition to being extremely high, SA inequality appears to be persistent, despite many efforts by government to reduce inequality since 1994, progress has been limited. However, SA is fortunate amongst developing countries to have abundance of survey data on different aspects of individual and household welfare. This enables Stats SA to conduct analysis on multiple dimensions of inequality, including income, employment, earnings, assets, social mobility, health, education, and access to basic services and infrastructure. So the purpose of the report is to provide a broad overview of these various dimensions in terms of inequality over the recent past using the latest survey data. The report further disaggregates estimates by population group, sex, and geography. The results of the report present evidence on both vertical and horizontal inequalities in the country. The motivation for the report is that inequality correlates with multiple measures of social problems. This includes health, education, mortality, crime, and substance abuse. Social stresses that are heightened due to high levels of inequality leads to a systemic breakdown in the social structure. Besides the effects on the individual, inequality affects economic development. High levels of economic or inequality means that large segments of society will be excluded from economic opportunities, limiting the individual as well as the performance of the economy. So it's a loss to society of both economic potential and productivity. Because of the breakdown in social cohesion, this can increase inequality and affect the capacity of government to govern effectively. Therefore, reducing inequality is a critical policy perspective. Reducing inequality will require changes to the structure of the economy, improvement in the quality of government services, and to ensure equal access and equal outcomes in terms of health and education. On the economic front, job creation and inclusive economic growth will be vital to reducing inequality. In terms of the structure of the report consists of five chapters. The chapter one is the introduction and background. Chapter 2 is the overview of the policy environment. Chapter 3 is the review of the data sources. Chapter 4 is the profiling and analysis of inequality. There are four broad measures, which is income inequality, asset and wealth inequality, labor market inequality, and inequality in the social domain. The last chapter is Chapter 5, which concludes. We must note that all the indicators in the report is not disaggregated to a provincial level. So some data you can find for the Western Cape, others you cannot. They just do it at the national level. So the first measure of inequality is economic inequality or income inequality. So this graph just shows the distribution of expenditure shares by decile. So the top 10% of the population, they spend more than 50% of the total expenditure within the economy. So the numbers given there is 57% in 2006. And 52% in 2015. The bottom 50% of the population spend less than 10% of total expenditure in the economy. So this graph shows that the expenditure inequality in our country. But one thing we need to note is between 2006 and 2015, for the top 10%, you can see that the expenditure declined, and the fifth decile to the ninth decile, the expenditure actually increased over this period. So this is evidence that inequality actually decreased between 2006 and 2015. Not a lot, but it's actually moving the right path. This graph shows the distribution of expenditure shares by sex of household head and population group. So the diagram on the left, it shows that males spend on average more than 70% of total expenditure in the country, whereas females spend about 25%. Males represent about 50% of the population and females about 50%. So males spend more than what they should actually be spending and females are spending less than what they should actually be spending. Then the diagram on the right again shows expenditure by population group. So black Africans spend around 45% of total expenditure, colors about 9%, Indian Asian about 4%, and then whites by 40%. So black Africans, in terms of population size, is about 80% of the population, yet the expenditures are running around 45%. The white population is about 10% of the country's population, yet they spend around 40% of total expenditure. But if you look at the trend between 2006 and 2015, for black Africans, expenditure increased from 41% to 49%. And for whites, it decreased from 45% to 36%. So we can see that inequality is decreasing amongst the population groups. This table is full of numbers. It just gives all the different inequality measures for per capita expenditure. The different ones you get is the Gini coefficient, the Thiele's index, Atkinson index, and the Palmer ratio. But the most important one is the Gini coefficient. If we go to the bottom row for total population, we can see from 2006 to 2015 that the Gini coefficient decreased from 0.67 to 0.65. The other important ratio is the Palmer ratio. Right in the bottom, in the right-hand corner, we see that the ratio decreased by 8.6 to 7.9. The way they calculate this ratio is they take the top 10% income and divide that by the bottom 40% income. So the 7.9 means that the top 10% earned 7.9 times what the bottom 40% earned. So if we go in the stats between the different population groups, we can see for black African, inequality actually increased. In 2006, it was 0.54. By 2015, it was 0.57. For colored, stayed the same by 0.56. Indians, it significantly decreased. And for the white population group, it decreased as well. So this table gives the inequality measure based on per capita expenditure by sex of household head between 2006 and 2015. So again, it gives the four different measures. The most important measure is the Gini coefficient. So we can see that for the total population, it has decreased from 0.67 to 0.65. When you look specifically for males, it decreased as well as for females. So between the sexes, inequality has decreased. For this slide, the first graph gives the distribution of per capita income from the labor market by income decile. So it just shows in terms of the different segments of the population, where do they actually get the income. So we can see for the top 10%, they get most of the income from the labor market, where the bottom 1% does not. The bottom graph just gives the distribution of per capita income from social grants. So there we can see that the bottom 1%, up until the bottom 4, receive the majority of the income from social grants, whereas the top 10% does not at all. So the second measure of inequality is the asset and wealth inequality. This figure gives a trend in the household asset ownership between 2009 and 2015. So Stats SA used 18 assets. Three of them is public assets, which are pipe water, flush toilet, and electrical connections. And 15 other assets is private assets. So most assets increase over time, with the exception of the tech, which is like DVD players, which decrease, radios decrease, as well as Wi-Fi. So the overall picture is that the assets actually increase over the six-year period. This figure again gives a distribution of the households by number of assets they own. The blue line is the amount of assets owned in 2009. We can see the majority of the households owned between 7 and 8 assets 6 years ago. In 2015, which is represented by the green line, we can see that the number of assets has increased per household. So the average number of assets owned now is probably between 9 and 10 assets per household. So we can see there has been improvement over the past 6 years. The figures here are the average asset scores and the asset Gini coefficients for the 6 households. On the diagram on the left-hand side, we can see that the number of assets has increased from 8.7 to 9.8. Assets for males has increased as well as assets for females. But if we look at the Gini coefficient again, between 2009 and 2011, the Gini has decreased, meaning that inequality has decreased. But between 2011 and 2015, we can see that the ratio has increased. So inequality has increased. But if you compare between 2009 and 2015, inequality has come down. With this diagram again, it's the average asset scores and asset Gini coefficients by population group of household head. And again, the period we're looking at is between 2009 and 2015. So on the diagram on the left with the average asset score, the number of assets has increased. But again, we notice between 2009 and 2011, there was improvement, but between 2011 and 2015, it has decreased. So the Gini coefficient for the assets show the same thing. So this is also a reflection that the state of the economy after 2011 has slowed down. That's why we see the increase in the Gini between 2011 and 2015. This is the last slide for asset and wealth inequality. This table just gives the average asset scores and asset Gini coefficients for and the population shares by province. We can see for the Western Cape, in 2015 we had a Gini coefficient of 0.52, which is a decrease from 0.56 in 2019. So the Gini coefficient is less than the average for SA, which was 0.59 in 2015 and 0.62 in 2009. Limpopo is the province with the lowest Gini coefficient at 0.51. I'm going to hand over to my colleague now.
I will be presenting on the labor market inequality. Okay. As Fabian has already mentioned, labor market income is the largest contributor to the income inequality, and it accounts around 71% in the country. And if you look at the labor market trends, which is sourced from the quarterly labor force surveys of SSA, from 2011 and 2017, you have on the first column your not economic active, you've got employed and then unemployed, and then you've got your unemployment rate. Your not economic active group is those people who are available or and are able to work, but who did not work a week prior to the survey. So if you look at the employed numbers, you can see it is stable, it's between 41.9 to 43.4, and your not economic active is actually decreasing from 44.3% in 2011 to 40.2% in 2017. When you look at the unemployed, you can actually see the percentage of the unemployed is going up, and it's reflected by your unemployment rate, which increased from 24.8% in 2011 to 27.5% in 2017. And then looking at the labor market trends by the population group for the same period, we started as the Black African, Colored, Indian, and White. On the Black African group, you can see the number of the employed is increasing. Also, the not economic active is also decreasing. But your unemployment rate is actually higher than the unemployment rate of the country, and is at 28.6% in 2011, increasing to 31% in 2017. The colored on the other side, also the unemployment rate is actually increasing, but at a very low rate, from 22.9 to 23.5. And also the Indian unemployment is actually it's more stable than the black Africans. Also, the white unemployment rate is actually increasing from 5.8% in 2011 and 6.7 in 2018. Okay, this actually graph shows the Gini coefficient and the Palmer ratio. Gini coefficient, which is measured by zero, reflecting perfect equality, and then closer to one reflects your perfect inequality. As we can see, from 2011 to 2013, your Gini coefficient and your Palmer ratio are actually increasing, and then they improved in 2014, but they went up in 2015. So both ratios are up in 2015, and they are more than your income to the position, because you can see now, when you look at employment, it's actually above the 0.68, which is reflecting more inequality. And then we look on inequality in the social domain, looking at education, looking at the proportion of learners aged 6 to 18 years old who are supposed to be at school, attending an educational institution by the province. And we can see South Africa, which is in the dotted line, is around, I think it's around 94%, attendance is around 94% in 2017, and it's actually improving. And your province, Limpopo, is actually above the national average. And then on the proportion of learners aged from 6 to 18 years attending public educational institution and benefiting from no-fee policy or no-fee school fees, you can see Limpopo is having a large number of the schools are no-fee schools, followed by Eastern Cape. And the Western Cape is actually around just below 50% of the schools are no-fee schools. But this is a reflection of the provinces, that is your Eastern Cape having high inequalities and your Limpopo in terms of Gini coefficients. And then we look at the proportion of households that use a health facility by type of health facility and population group. And you find that on the left looks at your public facility, and then on the right it looks at your private facility, where between 2009 and 2017, if you look in South Africa, about 74.4% were using public health facilities, and it increased marginally to 75.1% in 2017. And if you look across population groups, you'll see that 84.1% of the African groups, of your black Africans, are using the public facilities, and in 2009, and it actually dropped a little bit to 83% in 2017. And also, the colored population group is the majority is also using the public facilities, and it increased from 65.4% in 2009 to 67.6%. And the Indian and in the Indian group, it was 35.5.6 of them using the public facility, but it dropped marginally to 34.5 in 2017. The white population groups as an increase, but it's also marginal. And on the right hand side, then when we look at the private on the use of health facilities, you see that Black Africans, as already depicted on the other side, it was 83%, then it's like 17% on the private facilities. Your colored is 34%, decreasing to 32.4%, and your Indians, the majority, like 64.4%, when using the private facilities, increasing to 65.5%, and then your the white population group, it was 88.2% in 2009 and improving, and then actually it dropped to 87.4%. So basically, overall, in South Africa, around 24.9% of the population uses the private health facilities. And then looking at the percentage of individuals with access to medical aid by province, Western Cape, which is the blue line at the top, and Gauteng are the leading provinces which have access to medical aid, but you can still see that it's around Western Cape is around 25%, and also Gauteng is below 30%, and the South African average, you can see it's around 15% of the individuals have access to medical aid. Western Cape and Limpopo then is less than 10%. And then in terms of level of satisfaction reported on the use of public health care facilities, the graph actually say on the orange and yellow shows that either you are very dissatisfied or somewhat dissatisfied, and then your light bluish and dark blue says you are neither satisfied or dissatisfied, or you are somewhat satisfied or very satisfied. So basically, more than less than 80% of people who are using the health public care facilities are either they are satisfied or very satisfied, or they are neither satisfied or dissatisfied. Okay, in terms of the summary, we first look at economic equality. Where per capita expenditure was used to measure economic inequality, and the measures that were used were the Gini coefficient, the Lorentz curve, Thales and Atkinson indices, and then the Palmer ratio, as Fabian has mentioned. And these measures assist with assessing the trends in inequality over time, as well as between groups and within group inequality levels in the country. Consistently across the money measures, there was a slight improvement. It was from 0.67, and it improved to 0.65, and also your Palmer ratio actually improved from 8.6 to actually 7.9. Furthermore, while there was progress, it seems to have slowed down in the recent years. Like in 2009 to 2011, it was stable around 0.65, so there was no actual movement. And throughout the years, income from the labor market has been the main source of household income in SA, accounting for over 70% of the overall income. And also then, coupled to that, your labor market income is the largest contributor to income inequality when compared to other sources.
Social grants and remittances have played a crucial role in reducing the income inequality gap between the bottom and the top deciles over the years. In terms of assets and wealth inequality, the more assets a household owns, the more likely about households who are off-base to households who are less active. As already mentioned, there were a set of 18 selected assets and services was used to calculate the asset index. And overall, the distribution of household assets is less likely to provide, where it indicates that on average, households they own around 9 assets. And this approach allows for the estimation of Gini coefficients to measure assets in the economy. And it is said that in SA, in South Africa, wealth inequality is considered higher than the income inequality. Labor market inequality. We've seen that the unemployment rate has increased from an already high level of 24.8% in 2011 to 27% in 2015, and is even higher at 29.1% by the quarter four of 2019. And this is that the labor market experiences of different professions in SA continue to diverge substantially and still reflect the strongly persistent legacy of Africans. And then Black Africans, as it was shown in the table, had the highest unemployment rate, which were 4 and 5 times as higher as they were among the whites. And males have lower unemployment rates than females, and also they earn more than the females in the workplace. And in terms of the distribution of earnings, it actually also shows the heavily racialized inequality in the SAA labor market between your 2011 and your 2015, where both your Gini coefficient and your Paloma ratios were actually higher than those of the income or the off income.
And then also looking at the unequal development across South Africa, we can see there's regional inequalities in terms of access to education, health, basic services. And since 1994, the government has tried to eliminate these inequalities, but at varying degrees of success. Generally, the inequality has declined in some aspects, and we see that there's high attendance levels in the schools, as reflected in the graph. And also, notable was improvement in school attendance, as well as your low-fee schools that have been increased. It's about around 94% for Mpompo. But when it comes to health, with substantial differences from race and by province in the use of your public versus your health care facilities, and also having access to medical aid. And the inequality gap between subgroups in accessing electricity has substantially narrowed, also for water. And also the improved sanitation between rural and urban households. But still, the sanitation, which is measured by the access to smart toilet, is still below the 70% mark. And between 2009 and 2011, access to internet connections in both rural areas and urban areas increased, but it's actually at a low base because it's below 80%, because that point speaks to your connectivity in terms of your broadband, your Wi-Fi access, your public Wi-Fi access.
Thank you. I was looking at the internet connection earlier, and I saw that when you mentioned the DVD and radio and Wi-Fi DVD, that seemed more or less to correlate to the increases in electric connection. So satellite TV got used in internet, but that's a side
effect. Now, two questions per member. If you could just please keep your comments and questions as short as possible. Members,
members on the statement for your hand.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for this. The first one is inequality is a serious problem, and many countries are trying to address that. I can say, in the case of Stellenbosch, where I come from, the inequality decreased sharply in 2018 when a company by the name of Steinhoff collapsed. Yet, no poor person benefited from that. So I must warn that we must not only look at inequality, but we must really look at the income levels of the poor. And for me, that is where I think the graphs that you've shown in terms of household assets really, I think, is quite important for us. So my first question is, am I correct in to say that unemployment in South Africa is the biggest contributor currently to our even worsening, in some cases, inequality position? And secondly, can I just ask, am I correct in saying that it seems to me from the Gini coefficients as if Gauteng and the Western Cape were the two provinces where inequality was reduced most, was by 0.04 Gini coefficient points. And there was even a province where inequality, I think it was Free State, where according to the stats, inequality... inequality from 2009, 0.53, to 2015 even increased, whereas with all the other provinces we were able to improve the levels of, let's call it, quality equal. So why would it be that the Western Cape and Gauteng were the two provinces where we were able to improve from 2009 to 2015 by, as I've said, 0.04 percentage points? What would your reason be for that? Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. With respect to your guidance for us not to comment, I think firstly, for me, we do have offices in provinces. Perhaps in future, we must just invite them and request provincial treasury, because this is their report. I don't see why, and that's a state agent. So I don't see why we have to then ask the colleagues from treasury. Actually, all the treasury could have done is to give us an analysis from their point of the impact, you know, of the different levels of inequality in as far as the province, so that we answer, you know, the type of questions that member Vestazen is asking, because we assume that at least they sit with that data based on what are the interventions of the state. The first issue for me, I think when I read, perhaps in trying to get to the question mode, in the report itself in page 38, which I would now actually try and ask what would be your interpretation of what drives the, because one of the things that in the first paragraph it's reported is that according to the PAMA ratio, the highest inequality was observed in the Western Cape, where the top 10% of the population in that province shared 9 times more of total provincial expenditure.
So my question is, what
phenomenon from where you are sitting. The
second point, I think for me, is I think on one of the slides where you demonstrate, you know, the labor market income and size versus the social grant. Because what I see, and correct me if I'm wrong, in terms of interpretation, is that given that labor market, as it was said in one of your slides, is the biggest contributor to inequality, assuming that means people being in a job, that's the assumption that I'm making. Because when you look at other elements, having assets and everything, you still see a particular pattern and of a particular company.
Now, the question that I'm asking, if I look at this presentation on
slide number 10, is that what would be the picture? Would that be correct to say the picture would have been worse, actually, if you take out the capital income from social card? Because the indication that I read from this is that as long as you indicate with what is presented in the labor market inequality, that majority of people are outside of that, especially if you include those that are unemployed, those that are not economically active, if you bring both of those percentages and you actually take out the funds, the situation would have been worse. Would I be correct to make that particular assertion? And lastly, which is just my comment, I would think for me, and my interest would have been especially in this report, because at least I could read for myself from when the report was presented, is the correlation between this report and what Provincial Treasury has been producing over time in the Mero. Because for me, when I read this, there isn't much deviation actually in the early warning signs that the Mero has been giving us in terms of your socioeconomic profile, especially about Gini coefficient. Because what is here is actually indeed what has been depicted when I read the different year-on-year, you know, indications of the various municipalities in as far as Gini coefficient is concerned. So I think for me that is just a comment to say I think the work that the Provincial Treasury has been doing on the Mero is good work, and I'm hoping that as politicians sitting here together with yourself, you are finding a way of really getting the decision making to be influenced by the Mero. Because for me, when I see the interventions that we're doing both at a provincial level and even in the municipalities in terms of the economic decision, I don't think we are getting it. You see, so this inequality for me from a Gini coefficient is really not something new, because I've been exposed to the Mero reports produced by the Provincial Treasury. I think that was just my comment. Thanks.
Thank you. I will see you guys.
Okay, I'll try to answer the question if the labor market is the driver for income inequality. From outside, it's actually the economy. The Gini coefficient is a measure between income and the population and the distribution of that income across the population. So income is the important factor. So what drives the income is the economy or economic growth. So since the 2009-2008, we had the Great Financial Recession. Our economic growth has been on a slowdown since 2009, to the point we're not reaching more than 1% in terms of economic growth. In terms of income per capita or GDP per capita, it's been decreasing for the past 6 or 7 years. So though there is a slight increase in economic growth of less than 1% each year, per capita GDP has been decreasing for everybody. So for the past 6 or 7 years, people have been getting poorer. So in nominal value, the amount seems to be getting bigger, but in terms of what we can able to purchase goods and services, it's less as we're moving forward. Added to that is also inflation. So again, nominal value is increasing, but inflation is eroding the value of the money. So the economy is actually the driver for inequality, from our side.
Urban centers or economic centers for South Africa's Western Cape, at Gauteng and KZN. So more than 60% of, probably 70% of economic activity within South Africa comes from those three regions. So that means your biggest companies are located there. For Western Tech specifically, the financial sector, ecosystem for our economy. So we're talking about Investec, we're talking about Old Mutual, all these big companies are located within the Western Cape. So these guys who work for these organizations, they do get paid a lot. So that could be one reason why the farm ratio could be bigger for the Western Cape compared to the other provinces. So it all depends where these big companies are located. Because again, the farm ratio.
So they were the big earners as
correct. So the farm ratio is the 10% of the top 10 divided by the bottom
40%. Actually, I think from my side, it indicates that there's a need to actually improve your middle, 50% of your middle class, so that you reduce the inequality. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for sticking with us over the time.